It's time for Mac Geek Gab, and listener Uncle Jamie brings us our quick tip of the week with the Google app from the App Store can identify a song you hum. That's right, you hum it, and it'll get it. You press the microphone button and then search a song while playing the song, but unlike Shazam, Google can recognize the tune of the song that you're humming, not just a recording. So you can hum a song and it'll tell you the name of the song with a fair amount of accuracy in spite of my inability to carry even a very good tune. So give it a try. More tips like this plus your questions answered today on the Mac Geek Gab number 1042 for Monday, June 17th, 2024.
Welcome to Mac Geek Gab. We are the show where you send in tips like that we share. You send in cool stuff found that we share. You send in questions that we hopefully answer. At the very least, we will discuss and really try to impart what we know about the troubleshooting process. Even if we can't get to the actual answer, we can all learn something about the troubleshooting process when we do that. And in fact, that's the goal, is each of us learning at least five new things every time we get together. And when I say each of us, I mean all of us as the hosts. Like, we're all one big family of learners here, and we can help each other do that. And that's what we're going to try to do today here here on June 17th. June 17th, of course, being World Tessellation Day. But we are recording this on June 13th, which is Mac Geek Gab's 19th anniversary. So, you know, hey, 19, we can't dance at all.
Happy anniversary.
I know, pretty amazing. Sponsors for this episode include coda.io/MGG, where you can go and sign up for free. One doc to rule them all. You get to bring all your text and your tables together. It's very cool. And ecam.live, where you can go and you get 1 month free of Ecamm Live, this great all-in-one video streaming management platform. And then you can use promo code MacGeekGab at checkout for that 1 month free. We'll talk more in depth about both of those in a little bit. But for now, celebrating the beginning of MacGeekGab's 20th year here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in South Dakota, I'm Adam Christensen.
And greetings from Pleasanton, California. It's Pilot Pete.
I was
doing the pilot thing this week.
I was wondering where you were this morning, Pete. I could tell from your video that you were not at home. Or not rather, home. I could tell you were in a hotel. But yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
You're back in the area where I grew up.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Northern California. Yeah.
It's a beautiful sunny day, 55 degrees. And I think, was it Steinbeck or Mark Twain? So the coldest winter in my life was the summer I spent in San Francisco.
I believe that was right.
You know,
yeah.
One of those two.
One of those two. That's right.
Probably Steinbeck.
Yeah. This area, it's amazingly cool in the summer.
So this means that Mac Geek Gab, assuming we make it through this episode and release it, will have caught up to MacCast, Adam. So
Yeah.
But you already began your 20th year of podcasting back in December, of course. So you've just continued.
Yeah. I had started. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're still, no, you haven't ended. You're still here.
You're still casting.
Not your 20th year of MacCast.
But yeah.
Yeah. Podcasting in general, you haven't stopped. So yeah, there you go.
Yeah, you said World Tessellation Day.
That
made me think, well, maybe I need to go back and reinstall like Kai's power tools or something like that.
Oh,
get my fractal on.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Oh, I didn't.
I probably had that mathematically wrong. I don't know if tessellation and fractals are the same or similar, but I think they are.
I don't.
Are they not?
Yeah, I don't. That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I know tessellation.
Not a very good math geek.
Tessellation is like, I always think of tessellation as tiling, but I don't know. That's I don't.
Tessellation or tiling is the covering of a surface, often a plane, using one or more geometric shapes called tiles, with no overlaps and no gaps.
Yeah. So yeah, World Tessellation Day. There you go. Yep. There we are. All right. Thank you for sharing Uncle Jamie's tip to kick us off. Adam, you want to take us to Mark's?
Sure, if I get myself ready.
Well,
I was doing other things, but yeah, I can do that. So Mark has a tip. He says, if you open Control Center on the menu bar, the icon with the white and black toggle switches, you can drag any items from Control Center onto the menu bar. Just click on the item, such as Wi-Fi, and drag it to the menu bar. If you don't want any items on the menu bar, hold Command and drag them from the menu bar to the desktop until you see an X. Not sure how useful this is, but I found it interesting. I think it's very useful.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I didn't know you could take things. I mean, I just learned that. I didn't know you could take things from Control Center and throw them in the menu bar.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these things, if I were, prior to this moment in time, if I were to want to put something from the Control Center in the menu bar, I would have gone to System Settings and, like, turned it on there, which I think is in, like, the Control Center. What do they call that now? Like, Control Center, isn't there? Yeah, there's just a Control Center thing, and you can...
Control Center, yeah.
Yeah, you can turn it on for the menu bar or Control Center when you're in there. Right. Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, there's, like, a little drop down.
The question is, no, you can't. I was trying to see if you could take something from the menu bar and put it in the Control Center. Not as easy.
No, that's a great, but a good, like that worth trying if this other thing exists. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you hold down the Command key, you can rearrange icons in the menu bar. That's a whole nother quick.
That is correct. Yeah. The Command key will also let you arrange things. Yeah. Good tip. I love this stuff. Yep. Right. Yep. Yep.
I've got another one.
Oh, I think while we're talking about the menu bar, we had it slotted for later in the show, but now is a perfect time to talk about James brought up the fact that Bartender, the app for the Mac that allows us to have
control that menu,
more
that
control
and clean menu bar.
Yeah, to clean it up, to tame the menu bar, still works. Great. It is under new owners. Ben Surtees wound up selling Bartender. He said he couldn't support it as a solo developer anymore. And he has sold it to a company called Applause. He says, 3 months ago, I sold Bartender to Applause, a company with the resources and expertise to take the app to new heights. Applause shares my vision for Bartender and is committed to maintaining its core values while bringing in new features and improvements. This all came up because people figured out that it was under new management, new ownership. They never made an announcement about it, and there was some concerns, especially on Reddit, where this all sort of developed, that it might not be, like, we didn't know who these people were, and so is it still safe to use? Should we trust these people, et cetera, et cetera? And it seems like they're talking now, which is good.
Yeah.
But
well, yeah.
Yeah.
Transparency is always the best, right?
When
it does involve national security and you can be transparent, do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole thing was a little weird, and I was curious about it when I got the thing. I know that the developer came out and commented. I think you said that maybe the company themselves have commented a little bit as well. I'm not sure if I saw that, but when this came up, I did go look to try and figure out, you know, what is this company and what do they do? And I think they're out of New York.
Okay.
And it seems like they're in the business of doing exactly this, sort of like buying up apps from developers. Like, the whole company was founded for buying up apps from developers who just don't have the time to kind of maintain them, and they've got a team and they've got a staff, but I couldn't figure out like what other apps they have. I mean, they don't have a lot of information out about themselves, so I understand why people would be concerned.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. So I don't know anything about them. I don't know if they're good at what they do or bad at what they do or what happens to apps that come under their tenure. But yeah, I think being cautious about it. But I agree, like the lack of transparency is mostly what's concerning.
I reached out to the Applause folks when we first found out about this, and I haven't heard back from them. It seems like the only statement has come from Ben Surtees, who was the original author of Bartender. So,
yep.
I'm not, it remains to be seen. I can see what's the right way to communicate this thought. I can see why people would be concerned about a company like this, right? I mean, if they're just in it for the apps, right? Like the building up a portfolio of apps, what's the plan? We don't know much about them. I don't know of any other apps that like we all use or some of the members of our community use that are also under Applause's umbrella now. So we don't have a lot of experience with them. I can see why they would potentially like to just not have any friction with the user base. Just like, nope, it's steady sailing. We're going to keep it going. But to your point, Pete, people are going to find out, right? And it's better if you're the one that tells them your news as opposed to them figuring out your news. So, like, right.
And was there an issue with data collection or something? Is that how it got?
No, it was. Okay. Well, they updated their. The notarization of Apple's like through Apple's system to change, and that's how somebody noticed it. So
That has to happen. Like you don't have an option when you are a new developer or a new developer team because you have your developer account. The old developer has their developer account. You have to basically transfer that. So there's a process for that. And that means the keys change. And that means the authentication changes of the app.
Yep. For sure. Yeah. I will say this here because I know astute listeners, especially those on headphones, probably heard it. Pete, whatever your environment is, occasionally has like a low-end hum coming through your microphone. So just ride your mute. A little bit more actively than you normally would. Okay. That's all. Yeah.
I wonder if it's the fridge in here or something. Who knows?
It sounds like that. Yeah, it's that kind of a thing. Exactly.
Got a mini fridge in here. So.
Got
okay.
it. Got all it. Right. Just FYI. Yep. Right. It's coming through inconsistently. It's coming through regularly, but inconsistently enough that at least the tune out the background noise filters that we sort of have in place by default don't catch it. I'm sure there's one we could train to do it, but I didn't catch it before the show began. So
All right. Well, I'm going to leave my mic off of mute while I read the next
brilliant
quick tip.
Thanks.
That way I don't have to shout out the window quite so loud. Jed wrote in. He says, I unplug everything in my office every 6 months for therapy. Okay. He says he talked about the difficulty of reorganizing your physical workspace. He says, I go the other way. I unplug everything every 6 months or so and rewire. I find it very therapeutic and a good way to think about where everything is. And I've got to say, that's really not a bad idea. I had the other morning, I was standing in my living room and I'm like, do you hear that high-pitched tone? My sister's like, yeah, no, I don't hear it. I'm like, well, that's... And I went and opened the basement door and sure enough, my power had all gone off at some point overnight, and my battery backups ran until they were dead, and they were just sitting there beeping, and everything was off. I'm like, and it was difficult getting some of the things back on. So I had the opportunity to rewire all of my NAS drives and Mac Mini and all that, and now I know where everything is again. I was like, I forgot I had that little drive attached to my router, and
It's not. When I saw his note come in, I was like, huh. I always feel better after I do one of these, mass rewirings of a given sort of workspace, workstation, doing it being proactive about it. That's not a terrible idea. I've often said about things like that, it's better when it happens on my schedule than when it happens on technology's schedule. And because if only because I can carve out the time to do it when I'm doing it on my schedule as opposed to technology's schedule, which right. is like, oh, I didn't have an extra hour and a half to do this today. And yet here I am, you know. I kind of like it. I have not rewired my desk in my office in years. And that includes migrating from my iMac to my Mac Mini that's there now. Like, it's, you know, I just plug it in. It's like, oh, yeah, okay. Like, maybe the power cable changed because it's a different form factor of, you know, it's a different connector or something. Sure. But otherwise, it's like, all right, everything else is plugged in. Great. Let's just keep going. Whew. Don't have time for this today. But if I make time, that's not so terrible. Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
I won't tell you what mine looks like over here. That spaghetti mess of wires, even despite my best attempts to like make it clean when I first set it up. So you're giving me like twitches. It's like now I want to go like redo all that stuff because it's just like it's been bugging me for a while, but I just kind of don't look at it.
Yep.
So out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. But now,
like when we moved,
now that you brought it up.
When we put the generator in at the house last year, 2 years ago, whatever it was, and I moved all my NAS stuff and routers and all that over to a closet in the house, I bought like a little wire rack, like a baker's rack kind of thing, and put all the stuff on that. And it's awesome. Like, it was great rewiring, like Ethernet cables that only run down the back of it. And like, it's great. I used even wire ties and I love it. And I did leave room in it for the things that I knew I was eventually going to put in it, but didn't know what they were. So like, there's power run. Yeah, it can be fun. Yeah. It's good.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, Adam. Zip ties and Velcro cable straps are cheap.
Oh, I have all that. I have all that stuff. I mean, I have the split channel, you know, like wires, so things are bundled together so I can use my, you know, standing desk and all that stuff. But somehow, despite my best efforts, there's still wires and things. So
in all the wrong places. Yes. Yeah. Yep. That's what my office looks like for sure. Yeah. All right. Grumpy comes to us next. He says Carbon Copy Cloner has an option to back up cloud files like iCloud, OneDrive, etc. There's an article on their site about it, but he says it briefly downloads the file, backs them up, and then cleans up the downloads. So even the things that are on, you know, cloud, stay on the cloud only kind of thing, or stay on the cloud mostly. It pulls it down and then it's interesting. There's an article, as he said, and we'll link to that in the show notes at MacGeekab.com. But thought that was pretty good. Moving on to Chris.
Right.
Adam?
That's me.
You. That's you. Yeah. It's all good.
Oh, sorry. I'm okay. Not on the ball today, apparently.
That's okay.
Yeah. Chris has a quick dip.
He does?
Regarding something we talked about previously, which I mentioned the hassle of being a developer and having to set up like test Apple Pay accounts. The fact that I have to log out of my iCloud and then log back into the test iCloud and you go through the whole setup and turning things on and off and settings and stuff like that. He says, in a recent episode, Adam mentioned the hassle of setting up Apple Pay for web developer purposes. He says, Adam, you could set up a secondary user account on your Mac and log into that with the developer Apple ID. Then you don't have to change a thing with the primary user account. Well, now you tell me.
Yeah.
this is brilliant other than one thing. And so this is perfect for, you know, on my Mac testing and stuff like that. Unfortunately, I also do need to occasionally test on an iOS device. My solution for this has become I actually have an old iPhone that I use a separate device for. But if you don't have that, you know, as we know, and I don't know why, especially with iPad in 2024, why we still can't have multiple users on an iPad. Like iPhone, I get it. iPhones are very personal. iPads are also personal, but I could see a case, especially people who have kids, you know, families. Like, if we're going to make an iPad a computer, like, which is like it seems like Apple's trying to do,
yep,
it should have multiple user option for
I know why they don't do it. I know. I know one reason why they don't.
Why they do.
Yeah.
Sell four iPads instead of one.
That's you got it. Yeah. It's a personal device if we tell you it is. One piece of good news, though, is that macOS 15. I don't want to start. These names have gotten too confusing, right? Like whatever this new one is, macOS Sarsaparilla or whatever it's called. it, like, what is it? macOS Sasquatch or something?
Moonlight.
I don't know. Yeah. But like the names are too. We got Sonata and Sonoma and Sarsaparilla and Sequoia and I don't even know. So like I think it would be good for us to start just calling them by their numbers. So macOS 15, which is the one that's in beta now, coming out presumably in September or sometime in the fall.
That's Sahara, right?
That's Sequoia.
Or Savannah.
Is the new one, Adam. See what I mean?
Let's throw as much dirt on this pile as we can.
No, you know, earlier I did ask ChatGPT to come up with 10 quirky words that start with S and end with A. We have Samantha. They did put Sequoia on the list. I'm just going to note. Sophia. Spirulina. macOS Spirulina. That's going to be it. But macOS 15, we're on 14 is the current version now. I believe that's Sonoma. And then in Apple parlance, but I feel like it's gotten too confusing. So, but anyway, macOS 15 will allow you to create a virtualized container of macOS, which other versions have allowed. But what other versions have not allowed, but macOS 15 does allow, is for you to sign in to your iCloud account or a different iCloud account inside the virtualized container. So you could do the same kind of thing that we're talking about logging into a different account. You could do that with a virtualized container, and now you could have both of your accounts sort of live on the screen at the same time, one of them in like a Parallels or VMware container and the other as your, you know, sort of like host account. So I feel like that's pretty good. So, you know.
Yeah, anyway. That would work.
Yep. Taking us to Jim, Pete.
All right. I'm going to do so. Have you ever wanted to do electrical work in your home?
But yes.
Didn't know which breaker controlled which circuit?
Oh, yes.
So take a fork, stick it in the outlet, and oh, no, don't do that. but here's what you do. Take your Apple Watch charger and plug that into your outlet and put your Apple Watch on the charger and then go down to the breaker. And when you turn off the breaker for that circuit, watch the charge indicator on your iPhone. It'll go off after a few seconds, identifying the correct breaker. Thanks for all you do, Jim. And I have an additional portion of that tip, because if you don't have an Apple Watch, but you have AirPods, plug your AirPods charger into that, and you will also see your AirPods charge indicator in Control Center go off.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you try it?
I tried it
this morning. With a closed AirPods case? Or did it have to be open?
No, it was closed.
Oh, okay.
It was closed on the charger.
Closed on the charger. Okay, I didn't realize that was broadcasting. Okay, great. Yeah, because if I look on my phone now, it doesn't show me my AirPods status. But I guess if it's charging, it would. So, yeah.
Right.
Yep. Yeah, right. All right.
If it's fully charged, it may not. I don't know if it's fully charged and not actively charging at the moment.
Oh, interesting.
So wear your AirPods down and then put them.
Yeah. But like your watch is a great, like that, what a great little trick.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Huh.
So, and then after you've tried all the circuits in your house and finally get it, you get to go around and reset the clock on your microwave, your stove, your VCR, your...
We have standardized on never setting the clock on our microwave because our stove is Wi-Fi connected. And so it sets its own clock. And then the other clock that we have in our kitchen is a grandfather clock. And that is purely mechanical. So we set that. And it is truly a grandfather clock in that my grandfather built that clock and now it's in my house. So like grandfather, like in more ways than one. In fact, I think I even have a picture of me at like 7 years old or something standing inside the unfinished clock.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. I got to find that somewhere. All right. Taking us to Porthos John. Yeah, please.
Yeah. He has a cool tip for something that could be annoying if you were using a feature. He says, I use Mission Control Spaces constantly, both at home and at work. I like the idea of having an auto switch when I hit an edge. So that's when you hit the edge and it activates. But it was happening too fast, and I would trigger it accidentally all the time. I have that problem with hot corners sometimes. But he says, I found a quick terminal command that will hold the delay before it triggers space switch to 2 seconds. My choice, but you can choose whatever. So we'll have the terminal command, I'm assuming, in the show notes. I won't read the whole thing out, but it's one of the, you know, default write commands.
Yep.
Where you can change settings of certain things. And this one changes how the edge delay works in spaces. So that's pretty cool.
That's really cool. Oh, I could now, like, I've never had that part of this turned on for exactly the reason he articulates. Huh?
I don't know why they wouldn't expose that in the settings. Like, it baffles me sometimes. Like, how hard would it be in that setting to have edge delay and an input box,
dude? Yeah, it's not hard. Like that, like to answer the rhetorical question, it's not difficult. It's that Apple doesn't want it to be confusing for people. But yeah. Like, you know, they let us adjust the double click speed with a slider. Yeah. You could put a slider in and make it really kind of nice.
Yeah. That train has sailed. It's all confusing.
Can you delay hot corners
anymore? So yeah,
I don't remember if you can or not.
Yeah, that would be good. macOS delay hot corners.
But you know, it's just back to that other conversation. I would love to be on a fly in a wall because you have to imagine. I mean, these conversations come up, right?
Of course.
Hey, this feature has all these settings. Which ones are we going to expose? There is a meeting or some sort of, you know, Slack conversation that happens around this where like the team decides, okay, these are the things we let people change. And these are the things we're going to just tell them. This is the values, right?
Right.
It'd be just interesting to hear those conversations.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. These debates happen for sure. Yeah. I'm looking to see if there is a hot corner delay. There isn't, but the workaround, or I can't find one. I don't want to definitively say there isn't. There might be one. And if there is one, feedback at MacGeekGab.com, please, because we would love to know about it. But the workaround, what's that, Pete?
Where? Feedback at MacGeekGab.com?
I believe he said feedback at MacGeekGab.com,
okay.
Pete.
Okay.
That's right.
Just checking.
But the workaround is to add modifier keys to your hot corners, which you can do when you're setting your hot corners. You just hold down the modifier key when you're doing that. Yeah. And that way your hot corner will only activate, set the ones without modifier keys to not do anything and make it.
Right.
So you have to hold down, you know, command, control, option, whatever you want. So
yeah. That's a good tip. I actually need to turn that on because I have a hot corner for putting my Mac to sleep. And I constantly do that on a Zoom call at work. It's like, wait a minute, the Zoom call's still going. I can't see anything. And I'm trying to log back in. You know, luckily I have, you know, Touch ID, so it's not too bad, but
yeah. Yeah. Huh. All right. Cool. All right. Well, there's lots of, lots of things. Oh, this, I'm not happy. Something I did. Did you hear? Before the bell sound triggered, there was a little blip, and I don't like that because it means I messed something up with the way Farrago works with my audio, and I need to relearn how to fix that. Now, there's an issue. I installed the latest loopback, and that threw all kinds of things for a loop. It works fine for a lot of people.
I see what you did there.
Well, it wasn't intentional. It works fine for a lot of people, but for whatever reason with my setup, the new... They moved loopback from using Ace as the audio engine to whatever the new hotness is that they built. And while it works, the new hotness works fine in Audio Hijack, it doesn't work fine for me with loopback. And so they're working on that for us. Somehow I broke it. I got to look at my notes. Anyway, that's just me being obsessive about audio quality, which is part of why many of you still, I think, still listen after, you know, 19 plus years now of this, because we care about making it sound good for you. Speaking of which, we figured out the problem that was happening for Adam in the keynote rap show. So I think we've solved that too. We were asking Adam's computer to do more than we needed to.
Yep.
All good. Yep.
We're some wood to knock here.
Thank you for bearing with us when we have those issues. We're as unhappy about them as you are. So anyway, moving along, this would have been, if I were smart, I would have queued this up right after Grumpy's thing, because we're talking about iCloud. But Adam, you want to take us to JMM?
Yeah, JMM has a PSA for us. He says, "Dear fellow geeks, I just learned that I got caught with iCloud Drive, a text file, JSON file that I saved in my iCloud Drive shortcuts folder was overwritten by mistake. And when I tried to restore it, I learned that the file is not listed as with a restore option at all. I assume it's because it wasn't deleted, but overwritten instead. Also confirmed by Apple support. This behavior is different from other services like OneDrive, which keeps multiple versions despite being overwritten. Please learn from me and don't get caught."
Wow.
Nice.
So the file wasn't actually deleted. He just changed something or put a file with the same name, I'm assuming, and it just overwrote it?
Yeah, he overwrote it, you know, but for, like you said, yeah, for one of those reasons. But there was no versioning on that because...
I would assume it's maybe if it's only living in iCloud, like on my Mac, right? Because this goes to that tip earlier about backups, because I was going to mention that the way I get my iCloud files backed up is I have my Mac set to not optimize my iCloud drive. So every file on iCloud is synced to my Mac. So when my normal backups run, those files are backed up, which also means they're included in Time Machine, and Time Machine would have that version history.
Right.
I'm guessing if your file only lives in iCloud and has been deleted locally, Time Machine's not going to have any history on that file, I would imagine.
Right. And if he had deleted the file, it would be in the iCloud deleted files thing for some period of time.
30 days, unless you've changed that setting, right? That's a setting you can adjust, right?
I never touch
it, so.
But overwritten files, changed files, there is no versioning in iCloud Drive. So if you make a change to it, then the change, then it's not treated as something that needs to be kept in deleted files because it hasn't been deleted. So that is a good distinction to make, like, because like Dropbox, OneDrive, Synology Drive, they all keep versions, older versions of files to safeguard against exactly this. And iCloud Drive simply does not, according to JMM's experience here. So yeah.
No, that's true. I mean, they don't have versioning in the cloud for iCloud. Yeah. I don't know why. But...
All right, folks. Have you ever felt like your live streams and the videos you make could use a little extra magic? Well, don't get caught looking like an amateur. Get our sponsor, Ecamm Live. I just used Ecamm Live for an interview that was done with me, and it was a game changer. It worked so well. Ecamm is the all-in-one live streaming and video production studio for your Mac. Whether you're streaming, podcasting, running meetings, or recording videos, Ecamm has got you covered. You can stream and multi-stream, record high-quality videos, and present seamlessly into apps like Zoom, Teams, and Meet. Think of it as your personal video production studio. Camera switching? Check. Adding graphics, lower thirds, logos? Check, check, check. Bringing on guests? Double check. And the best part, it's super easy to get started, but fully customizable for all of us, like nerdy tech enthusiast type of people, right? You can be either. You can be the super simple part, or you can dig deeper and really tweak it to do everything your heart desires. So if you're ready to up your game, don't get caught with a boring stream. Get Ecamm Live. And you can learn more at www.ecamm.live. Get 1 month free of Ecamm Live using our promo code MacGeekGab at checkout. That's 1 month free of Ecamm Live when you use our promo code MacGeekGab at checkout. visit www.ecam.live. And our thanks to Ecamm Live for sponsoring this episode. All right, look, we all have projects to manage, but do you ever feel like managing one of your projects is like herding cats? Well, don't get caught in a productivity black hole. Get our sponsor, Coda. I've used Coda to coordinate my team from one of my other businesses here, and it has been fantastic. Coda brings together the best of documents, spreadsheets, and apps into one super platform. It stops you from ping-ponging back and forth between tabs and tools, making collaboration with remote colleagues a breeze. When I'm working with this other business, it literally keeps us on the same page because everything is there. With Coda, you can manage your planning cycles in one spot. You set and measure your OKRs with full visibility and instantly collaborate on documents and roadmaps. Plus, you've got access to hundreds of templates to get inspired by others in Coda's gallery. And this makes it really easy to see how you can get started with your business. Just start going through the gallery and you'll get some inspiration. Whether you're tracking projects or just trying to stay sane, Coda is your go-to. If you want a platform that empowers your team to collaborate effectively and focus on shared goals, you can get started with Coda today for free. Head over to coda.io/MGG. That's coda.io/MGG to get started for free. coda.io/MGG. Don't get caught in the chaos. Get started with Coda today, and our thanks to Coda for sponsoring this episode. All right, we'll do some questions now. This first one, though, I think becomes more of a hidden quick tip than a question because I'm not sure I know the answer or have an answer. But Don writes and says, I have been using Safari profiles for a while now, and it's great, he says, that you can designate different domains to open in the desired profile. However, I have yet to figure out how to edit this list. And here comes the quick tip that I didn't know about. You go into Safari, go to Settings, Websites, General, Open Links with Profile. This lets you edit the current open websites. But sometimes I want to add a link that I get in an email to a specific profile. Most often these links. So let me stop for a second and explain what this does, because it wasn't clear to me until I went into it. And then we'll get on with this question. So this Settings, Websites, open links in with profile, which is sort of down the list. It shows you every website that is open, and you can say with those, you can use those to configure it and say, all right, look, any links to this website. So let's say I have Mac Geek Gab open, right? I can say open this in the most recent profile. So it'll just open in whatever profile I have open. But I could set it, open this in my Mac Geek Gab profile. And then every time I click on a Mac Geek Gab link, it would open a new window or an existing window with the Mac Geek Gab profile, not like my main or a different profile, and then open the link there. So that's that to me, that's the quick tip. I had no idea that this was even a thing, and I love it. His problem is the only things it shows you in that list are currently open websites. And here's where this becomes an issue. He says, sometimes I want to add a link that I get in an email to open in a specific profile. Most often these links are in an email that do not start with the URL of the site that it's going to direct to. A lot of times he uses the New York Times email as an example, but most email links want to be able to track you, to know that when you clicked it, you clicked that link, and then they'll redirect you. And in fact, I think our MailChimp like show notes would do this too, right? MailChimp, the link goes to MailChimp first and then to, you know, wherever it goes. And so the problem is, you would never have a web window open or a tab open with that link or with that URL, because it redirects so quickly from wherever it goes, like MailChimp, to NewYorkTimes.com. And therefore, he can't set it to open in a specific profile. And he's wondering if we know how to do that. And I don't think there's a way other than, I guess you could look at the email. Right. Let's think about this. Right. You could look at the email, the source of the email, find or copy the link from the email and then instead of just pasting the whole link in, only paste in the like the very beginning of it. So if it's you know, redirect up MailChimp.com/ and then some big long serial number or something that, you know, applies to the link, take the serial number off. And maybe if you just go to redirect.mailchimp.com, and I don't even know that that's a real domain. So like, but I'm just right. making it up. Like if you were to put that in your browser, it might just stick. It would probably give you like, there's an error. I don't know what you want me to do, but that's fine. Cause while it's up, then you could go into this setting in Safari and add it to the list. That's that. I don't know. Right. Like other than that, I don't know, but it's cool to learn about the feature. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that, Pete or Adam?
No, that's a stumper. Yeah. Cause I get what you're saying. Like these are all over the place, right?
Yeah.
Tracking links and all that fun stuff. Right.
Correct.
Yeah. So you try to strip out any tracking that's in there and,
yep.
and go, yeah,
I have noticed, you know, I've been using Thunderbird as my email client. And when I go to click on a link in Thunderbird that has that, you know, redirection in it, it will pop up a little dialogue and ask me, do you want to go to the actual link that's here? Or do you want to go to the end result of this link? Like it'll say, do you want to go to newyorktimes.com? And so I can click newyorktimes.com. And then that would actually work for in Don's example.
Yeah, I think I used to have something like that too, where the way it worked was there was an app or something. This was a while ago that would do exactly that. It would recognize, you know, the short links and auto expand those. And it was also, I think, take care of some of these redirect links for like known like endpoints. And so you would set that as your default browser, right?
Yes.
And everything would pipe to that first, and then it would do its magic and then push to, you know, Safari or your actual browser. So it would sort of act as a proxy almost for like every link that you would click on, no matter where you clicked on that link. So it could be in your email, it could be in your, but I don't remember the app or the thing, but I remember playing with one of those tools once.
You know, I wonder if just using one of those tools would be enough. Like I use Velja, whatever it is, to basically so that if I click on a Zoom link, it just opens the Zoom app instead of going through the bonus page in Safari or Google Meet links. I find work way better in Edge or Chrome than they do in Safari. So I just have it open Meet links in Edge for me. But I wonder if it would by nature of that sort of pass-through process, I wonder if it would fully realize the redirection on the link. And then by the time Safari gets it, it would have New York Times as opposed to, all right, well, I'll put Velja, I don't know how to say it, in the show notes and maybe, but if not, something like that, or if somebody knows of whatever the name of the thing that you can't remember, Adam, is, that would even be better.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
There's an open in is in setup. Does the same thing.
That might have been it, actually.
Okay.
I think that is it, maybe. Okay.
Open in covers browsers, email clients.
Yeah. Okay. So that might be your answer. Open in. Yep. All right. So there you go. Yeah, there's more than one way to skin Schrodinger's cat. I like this. Right. That's good.
Use Occam's razor to start.
Very well played. I like it. All right, Pete, you want to move us on here?
I shall do so at this time because Rick in Atlanta writes in and says, "Good morning, Dave."
Hi.
Adam and Pilot Pete, not so much, I guess. Well. Just kidding. Good morning, Dave. Love the podcast. Never miss it. I have what should be an easy question. Uh-oh.
Yeah, that's never a good start. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. This actually may be. He says, if I set up Time Machine, does my backup disk have to be dedicated? Is it a clean disk, or can I use that disk that has other data already on it? Thanks, Rick in Atlanta.
Yeah, and the answer to that is yes, sort of. And the reason for that is, you know, typically when you set up Drive for Time Machine does its thing and says, you know, you plug in it in or you select it from Time Machine. It says, okay, I'm going to make this a Time Machine volume. And then it does its Time Machine thing and it formats that whole volume for how it wants to be. And now you have a Time Machine disk. So yes, in that context, but you know, it's a disk. So you could go into a utility like Disk Utility ahead of time, right? And create different volumes within that disk and use one of those volumes for Time Machine and then have the other volume available for whatever else. So, yeah, I mean, you just have to like make the system think you've got multiple volumes, you know, a partition or whatever you want to do, set up multiple volumes. And that should work. I do not recommend that personally, because in doing that, right, if something goes wrong with that disk, both things die, right? It's it's not, there's no redundancy to it. There's like, there's very little advantage in my opinion, like disks, especially, you know, spinning drives, but even more and more so if you care about speed of Time Machine, which I'm not hugely worried about, but SSDs, they're cheap enough. Like I would just dedicate a disk to Time Machine and have what I need there. And then if you need other storage, get a different system, a different disk. You know, you probably want better performance. And you can just get a cheap slow drive for your backups. Like, I don't know. That's always been my opinion.
Huh. Yeah.
Lots of storage, low cost. Like, it's just there to back things up in the background most of the time. Like, you're not, you know, recovery might take a little bit longer if you don't have an SSD. But again, if you want to splurge on an SSD, fine. But I just think Time Machine should just be a dedicated drive, personally.
Yeah. I would agree with you. My pause is I'm thinking about my clones, which are less and less clones now in that they won't boot a machine. But my clones, I've always put on a second volume on a big Mondo data drive that I have, right? Like every one of my desktop Macs has its internal drive and some big Mondo data drive. And the big Mondo data drive stores a bunch of data and then also has the daily carbon copy cloner backup now, because it's not so much a clone of, you know, my system volume. And that's just because I don't want to dedicate a whole disk if, you know, if my internal drive is 1 terabyte or like on this machine on my Mac Studio, it's 512 gig. So it's like, well, yeah. I guess I could go get a 512 gig drive or, you know, even a 1 terabyte drive, but I've got a 4 terabyte drive here. So I'm just going to carve out 768 of that or however much I need for my clone. And then I'm good to go. So that's why I do it that way. But for Time Machine, yeah, I'm with you.
Bigger drive, you got more history. You know, like if you want a huge drive, or like my general rule of thumb, because I don't care about a ton of history, is I generally do 2x whatever my internal drive is for my Time Machine drive, and that's been sort of how I've always done it, right? Because it remembers differences anyway, so it doesn't fill up super fast, but at least you have history. I can usually go back a year or two with no problem on most files. Yeah. With that rule of thumb that I've been using for years.
Makes sense. Any thoughts on that, Pete, before we move on?
No, I could totally agree. Get the, you know,
the
vision. Don't let Time Machine take over. It'll take over on you.
it will take over. Right. It is. Well, you can set it. Oh, on network volumes, you can limit it now, but right. Yep. Adam, we have another question for you. Deborah, wrote in and says, I wrote in a couple of years ago to ask about email archiving, and I'm still wondering about it. After my first message, though, Dave, you went and set up your own IMAP server. Yeah, I did. She says that's not really an option for me. Adam has said a couple of times that he has used or that he used to use Mail Steward. My question now is, if Adam, you are no longer using Mail Steward, what are you using?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is nothing.
Oh, really?
I'm using the cloud. I have all my email in IMAP. I mostly use for my IMAP Google whatever they're calling it now.
Google apps for domains or something. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Used to be Google Workspace. Gone through a million names, and back when I got my first one, it was free. So like that was a no brainer. So, I'm just relying on Google to make sure that they, keep all my email. Knock on wood, it's never been an issue. The other thing was I realized that I am okay with the ephemeral nature of most email. Oh. And I don't have anything that I've saved in any of my emails that's so valuable to me that I would be devastated if it was gone forever. I think I have some family emails and, I use folders, obviously. So I set up, IMAP folders and I organize everything. And so for example, a great one is I have a trips folder that has every trip, that I set up in it. So I have one for every Mac stock. But, if my Mac stock, hotel reservation from 20, whatever went away. I don't think I'd be crying about it. It's there. So anything super critical, I guess, if I had to, I might open up mail because I use Spark most of the time as my mail client. I could go into mail and move things over to my Mac.
Yeah.
I could create an on my Mac folder if I really wanted to archive something locally. I mean, that's pretty easy to do. And if you're a mail user, that's a good option. You could just, make sure that you save critical or move critical emails to those on my Mac folders, and then it would get backed up with your normal Mac backup. But yeah, I just haven't worried about it too much. Anything that's recently downloaded in theory would be, a copy would be in my, mailbox folder and would have gotten backed up by my normal backup, but obviously that's transient, right? Stuff flows through that and goes away and new stuff comes in.
Do you pay now for storage on Google Workspace or whatever that is? No, you still have the free account.
Yeah, you have to, right? I just have the whatever user account, so whatever default storage they give you for the $5 a month or per user, whatever they're charging these days.
So yeah, I think it's like 30 gigs or something. Yeah, okay. Got it.
Yeah, I've never run into storage problem. I'm pretty good about keeping my email clean. Again, I use tools. I don't, I make sure I delete all my spam. I'm constantly emptying spam folders. I'm constantly deleting, newsletter. I don't keep that stuff. I don't let it archive that stuff. I literally delete those and empty my deleted mailbox frequently. I think I have it automated to clean itself. So yeah, I don't know. Again, I don't worry about email. If your emails are really important to you, this is a great question. And that's when I would recommend something like Mail Steward or, using the on my Mac folders. Unfortunately, I don't think that works for iOS devices, though. So if your primary device is an iPad, like my mom, I don't know what you would do for email. If you wanted to actually back it up, I guess save it out to PDFs and files.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What about you, Pete? Yeah. What do you do?
I'm much like Adam in that, but although I don't think I'm as good about deleting and getting rid of, I have a lot of old email that I just don't need, but I don't worry about it too much. If it goes, it goes. There's very few things. The few things that I do need, I do pull off and save as a document somewhere, that sort of thing. But that's it. I'm really lax about email archiving.
Yeah, attachments are usually the thing I want to save. Right? Somebody sends me a photo or somebody sends me an actual document. So documents would go into files. Photos usually go into photos. So if a family member sent me a photo and I wanted to save it via email, it would go someplace else.
Yeah. Right. And if I need the text of the email, then I will, print and save as PDF.
Wow. Yeah. You me not same. I have
no,
not.
No, I know you have every email ever sent or received.
Well,
right?
Not quite. I have not embraced the ephemeral nature of email for me, but I do delete my spam. I go through my newsletters and delete those, read and or delete, right? But pretty much everything else goes into my archive folder, and I don't I have not chosen to carve out the time that it would take to be intentional about that archiving process. It's like, is it spam? Is it a newsletter? If the answer is yes to either of those, I delete it when I'm done with it. Otherwise, it gets saved, and that's that. And even press releases I have saved. And that, like, that's the thing that most frequently is valuable from the past. Finding a press release, and it's not because I need to know, like, what was the version number of, you know, this app whenever they added this feature. No, it's contacts. Because so much, you know, I've always said that part of my success in business in general is relationships and just keeping in touch with people and, you know, all of those things when appropriate. And whenever we mention something on the show, I like to alert the people that we've talked about it, or if we were going to mention something new or something we've never mentioned before, but it's not new, having that archive of press releases is super valuable, because I can go back and be like, oh yeah, okay, well, I've been in touch with this person and this person. Okay, great, I can reach out to them. And it's a whole lot easier than having to go through the front door of just like email info at and hope that you'll never hear from someone, you know, those kinds of things. So I find there's other things that of course are valuable in my archive too, but it's the press releases that most frequently are the things of value, which is why I do what I do. Mark M. in Discord recommends Mail Archiver from Moth Software as an archive utility. And he says, I moved my IMAP archive to Mbox using Mail Archiver X. I guess it's Mail Archiver now. There's no more X. But anyway, same thing. He says the latest beta now allows the ubiquitous Mbox. So we'll put a link to that in the show, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't.
I mean, I've got Mark in Discord said he's got email back to 1995. I've got some in my mailbox. It goes back as early as April of 2010, which isn't. It's about 3 years after I came over to Mac. Yeah. But that, you know, that's as long. I've had that domain since 1995 or 96. Yeah. But so there's stuff that's there. But I don't care if it's gone. It's gone.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I have email in my IMAP for like a domain that I've had since the early 90s or whatever, like with the first domain I ever registered. And I'm sure there's email in there in IMAP that goes way back into the 90s.
Yeah.
But I just honestly don't worry about it. I've never looked at those emails like since I got them in the 90s.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
I've never ever gone back to them.
Yeah,
so if they went away tomorrow, like, why would it matter?
Yeah. You're not wrong. What is interesting to me is how often this subject comes up. Like, even in the 6 months or so since you, I think almost 6 months exactly, since you joined the show full time, Adam, we've had this conversation three times now, maybe four times. Like, that's a lot for us to revisit a topic. So, and it's all at your urging, folks, right? Like, you're the ones that send this in, and we don't answer every question that comes in on the show, of course, but usually, you know, this one winds up floating to the top. So it's interesting.
Well, you see a theme.
Yeah.
You know where this might matter, I think, to a lot of people is, you know, we all now build such a large digital history.
Yes.
And it's probably more important to my kids than it is to me. Like, they might want that information someday, right? There could be information buried in the stuff that I did. Like, I think about, you know, all of the Maccast audio files that I have all the every original, like, recording unedited, like, those are all archived and saved, you know, and I have them backed up in multiple places and stuff like that. Not so much for my email, and again, I don't ever go back to those things either, but I've deemed them important enough to save. I don't know why email is different for me.
You're right. Yeah, but I think that's I think you're spot on there, that's why this comes up, because it is a part of our digital history. And again, for some of us, you know, different pieces of that are important for different reasons. So yeah, makes sense. Yep. You want to take us to Prof Josh for our next question here?
I can do that.
Great.
There you go.
Prof Josh says, how do I stop maps from offering me directions on where it thinks I want to go? So he says, today my kid's soccer is in two hours and it gives me directions for it on my way out of the gym. Not useful. Also, my wife's work hours say 12 to 4 p.m. and it is in our shared calendar. If I get in my car to go anywhere within that time frame, it gives me directions to her office. Is there a way to turn off this feature altogether? I don't want it. Edit. When I say giving directions, I mean that there's a map notification pop-up that I get I would like to eliminate.
Yeah.
So especially I know exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah.
And that's a simple answer, but I wish I could say I got it, but Ben in Discord helped put that answer up there. So you go into settings, S-Lady in search, maps, and suggestion notifications, and you can turn those off. So, yeah, they're sometimes annoying. I like them sometimes.
Yeah.
Then I'm kind of like, oh, who's watching me? How do you know I want to go there? But more often than not, I agree that those are kind of useless.
Well, Apple is watching you, and you know where that is, too. Like, I thought I'd bring this up. So if you go into, I think it's security, privacy, and your location data, it's like buried way down in there. But you can see the history of, like, all the places it knows that you frequent, right? And that's where that data is coming from. So by having GPS on your iPhone and stuff like that, this came up the other day. We were driving in the car, my wife and I, it was Saturday, and normally on Saturday we have this running thing where we meet a friend and we go have some beers and just hang out on Saturday afternoon and enjoy, you know, our downtown. And we were not doing that this one day, and we're driving in town, and she's like, why does Maps say we're going, giving us like the estimated time to get to that place? And I was like, oh, well, this is why. Because normally at this time, that's where we would be. And so it thinks we want to go there now.
We have the same thing. Maps recommends when we leave the house at the right times of the right days, it either suggests that we should go to the local Chinese food place or that we should go to Tideline Public House, which is this new like tap room food truck kind of thing. I have never once asked it for directions to either of those places, by the way. Like, it just knows that I go there frequently enough that it offers to get me directions to those. But I know how to get to these places from my house. Like, there's never been a time when I've asked.
One's right around the corner. So
one is literally walking distance. Correct. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and it's the tap room that's walking distance, which is the better of the two.
So.
Yeah. And I wonder, like, with iOS 18 and the new Apple intelligence frameworks and stuff, will we see even more of this, right? Because that's essentially what this is. And B, could I tell it, hey, S Lady, don't give me directions to Tideline Public House anymore. Like, don't offer me that as a suggestion. Like, I want other suggestions. I don't want to turn them all off, but you don't need to turn that on, because when I have somebody in the car, I don't need them to, like, think that I'm there all the time, even though that may or may not be true.
There all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other interesting thing about that, and it's in the, I think it's in the security and privacy settings, and because I wound up turning mine off. It's that whole trusted location thing. And if you change your password and you have to wait an hour and all, my home has never, ever, ever come up in trusted locations. I wound up having to wait an hour after doing some security stuff. I just went in and turned that off. It's the whole, what is it called? The lost or stolen device.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I do, yes.
Yeah, and my home has never come up as a trusted location, even though at that point in time, I'd been home for several weeks. It should have known. That's where I'm spending the vast majority of my time.
Yeah, but so that setting, just FYI, if you go into security, privacy, this is on the Mac, security and privacy, location services, and then you have to scroll all the way down to the bottom, and you'll see system services. Click on details. And then what you'll see is significant locations, and you can click on details there. And that's where it'll show you a summary of like records and locations. Although I'm noticing now they're not all there on my Mac. Maybe this is more useful on your iOS device. I don't know if it's device specific, but anyway, there'll be data in there sometimes. Mine shows that there's 94 records between April 20th and June 9th. But it's only showing me one recent record. I don't know how you view the full.
I don't know that we get to view the full thing anymore. Yeah.
But Yeah.
Yeah.
So you could also, I mean, if you don't want that at all, I guess another thing you could do is you could turn off significant locations. And I think that's what drives this data.
Yes.
So you're right. You could turn that off in your security and privacy. I don't know if it's used other places other than maps.
Yeah.
So you may just be careful with that because you may be disabling other features that you do want.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's probably better to do what was already recommended.
Exactly. Yep.
I bet law enforcement could find it if they need it. Just saying.
Oh, yeah. Maybe, right? Like, yeah. It's in there clearly, but
yeah.
if there's no UX to get it out, I mean, you could take a backup of the phone and you know, you, like, essentially take a forensics dive through that backup's data. Maybe it's there in an unencrypted way once you've unencrypted the backup. I don't know.
Yeah.
I need to go review that document that Apple has, but I'm pretty sure that stuff is stored locally and on the secure enclave on your devices and Macs.
So not
and,
in the backup. Okay. Yeah.
I doubt it. Or if it is, it's again, we'd have to double check, but
yeah.
Apple has a list of all the places, but I'm pretty sure location data they protect pretty well from what I remember.
I think you're right.
But it's been a while since I've researched that.
No, I seem to remember that from like when we discussed it for a TMO article where it was like, yeah, no, this stuff is not, it doesn't leave the device. Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, they've locked down almost everything. I think the only exception is like you do have that option where you can let Apple have the keys to certain data, like stored in iCloud, so that if something happens to you or you completely forget your logins or whatever, Apple support can help you do that, where they save your secret key. But I mean, you can choose to not do that, and then, which I don't, like, I don't let them have that, but you can.
All right, should we jump to Cool Stuff Found as we wrap things up here and begin our 20th year? You want to take us to Adrian?
I can do that. So Adrian is reminding us about something. It sounds like I haven't been around this long, but Adrian has been providing a link to a Google document every time a new version of iOS comes out. Looks like since iOS 15. And says, hey, I hope you're all well. It's time for my annual email, another year, another beta, another app compatibility spreadsheet. And there's a link to a Google Doc. Is this something Adrian puts together, or is this something
I get
found
the feeling that Adrian coordinates this? But regardless, it is actively managed and coordinated. It is crowdsourced data, but yeah.
Got it. So it's a crowdsourced Google Doc that we'll have a link to that you can go see what's compatible. And I think hopefully most things are, but I can't imagine too much has changed. But it'll tell you what apps are going to be compatible with iOS 18 beta.
I scrolled through it, and it's interesting. There are multiple entries for some apps where, you know, someone will say, this doesn't work, and another person will say, well, it worked for me. And you can see what might be different about their two, you know, setups or devices or any of that. But for the most part, it's, you know, all the apps just work. The one that jumped out at me as I scrolled through this was the New York Times app does not launch for all the people that have submitted to this. So that was interesting to me. But it happens. And there was something else that complained. I think it was like a bank app that complained your phone must be jailbroken or you know, something like that. And it's like, well, no, but it's just a version you've never seen before. So that makes sense. But you know, some of them are like it partially works and you know, that's an interesting thing to know as well. So, yeah.
Is this where we give the PSA about installing iOS betas? Like,
sure.
Few days after Worldwide Developer Conference. Like, I would not advise doing it unless you really know what you're doing and you care about your, you know, device functionality and stuff like that. I mean, these are betas for a reason. So, you know, don't put it on a device that you rely on day in and day out. I would not advise doing that, at least not with early betas. Like, wait for maybe some of the later public betas closer to launch, you know, when things get more stable.
I most people that I know that are running the betas are saying that they are some of the most stable first betas they've ever seen.
Oh,
You know, but take that with, you know, that and about $8 will get you a cup of coffee. But you might want to bring that $8 in cash just in case your phone running the developer beta can't do Apple Pay at Starbucks. So,
right, exactly. Right.
You know, so,
well, and then I get this, I'm sure you have too, and we will get the support emails where someone says, you know, my iPhone battery is like gone to crap and everything is, you know, running hot and everything's really weird and I don't know what's going on. And then you email them back and I'm like, are you running the beta? Oh yeah, I installed the beta.
Yeah.
Well, I can't help you.
Right now there's only developer betas out, right? There's the public betas have yet to be released. But that will happen soon, within the next week or two, I would presume. So the one thing to note, because as we were watching the keynote and the State of the Union, I still haven't watched Gruber's talk show, which I want to, because he had Federighi on again, and that's always a good, and I treat that as, you know, keynote part three, because there's always something informative there. But as of the time we've recorded this, I don't even know if it's up on his site yet, but it probably is. It is not yet, to my knowledge, so I can't watch it because I wasn't out there. But in any event, as I was watching it and they were talking about the Apple intelligence stuff, I was tempted. It's like, oh, this is actually something I would want to test out and get some experience with. That stuff's not in the parts of that that we would want to test as end users is not available in the betas yet. They're saying that's coming in the fall. My guess is it will come in a late stage beta, but it's also possible it will come after they are released. So that little bit of temptation is not yet a carrot hanging out there for us. So
right,
bear that in mind as you make your decisions as to whether you're going to install these betas. So,
yeah. And also remember when making that decision that Apple Intelligence is only iPhone 15 Pro.
Right.
And M1 Max and iPads and later. So if you don't have either of those things and you're looking to do it to get Apple Intelligence, you don't need to bother.
Yeah, it's not magic. That's true. Yep. Yeah. Really good point. I wonder why it's the 15 Pro and not the 14. Like, I have all kinds of questions about that. But anyway, Kiwi Graham in the Discord recommended a utility called Mints. There was a discussion about, can I look at my Spotlight indexing logs on the Mac and trying to troubleshoot some things? And he recommended Mints, which is, very nebulously defined as a multifunction utility. But it is the more expanded definition of it is, or description of it is, a growing collection of tools which provide tailor-made log extracts for investigating problems and exploring macOS. Collate various information about a Mac which can be difficult to find elsewhere, perform a set of tests on Spotlight, and provide specialist tools for certain types of data. Of course, there's more reading that would take some of the nebulousness out of that as well. But it's an interesting little thing, and I think looking at the screen of all the things, the logs that you can bring up, like iCloud, the Time Machine log, the TCC log, which is the I forget what TCC stands for, but it refers to the privacy thing on your Mac where you're turning, like, can this app have access to accessibility? Can this app have full disk access? Like that whole TCC thing, you can see the logs for just that. Boot logs, there's a whole section on Spotlight. So if you are looking to troubleshoot things on your Mac and you're not sure where to look, Mints might be a good utility to start with. And I wanted to discuss it, A, so we all knew about it, and B, selfishly, so that hopefully I remember it now that I've talked about it in the future when I need to do this kind of thing. So Mints. Have either of you ever used it? Or
I have not.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's...
No, I mean, I typically just fire up console. I don't know if there's different. It looks like it has a different UI, but like,
yeah,
console has the sidebar where you can get crash reports, spin reports, log reports, and it has all those logs listed out. I mean, it might not be as clear as what they are, but...
Well, I think console doesn't... There aren't separate logs for these things anymore. So I think this is like an intelligent set of filters that Howard has built for the main system, you know, for everything that's sort of dumped into system.log or whatever. So
that looks really cool.
Yeah.
That looks like a lot of effort went into that.
Yeah. Well, nice. that's Howard Oakley. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. In fact, he explains what that's exactly what it is. He explains what the filters are on the page he's using. So, yep. Yep. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, look at that. Yeah, those are all the... So they kind of pulls them all together. That's nice.
Yeah, it is. Nice. Yeah, he's built these filters that have helped him, and now he shares them sort of coalesced into an app. So, yeah, pretty cool. You got one last one for us, Pete?
I do. This comes from Randy, and he says, pass to you wallet app, iOS app. So it's pass, the number 2, the letter U, wallet. It makes you add and manage all of your cards, tickets, passes, etc. in Apple Wallet easily. You can add and store cards, membership cards, rewards cards, coupons, stamp cards, movie tickets, boarding passes, business cards, identity cards, gift cards, event tickets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's all that. It has a store of templates that uses various stores of loyalty cards, and you can just enter your own barcode or number or QR code even. You can put those in there. So that looks like it makes the wallet much more granular control, gives you more granular control over it.
That's cool. So this is going to let you put things into your wallet that the vendor does not, where the vendor does
doesn't
not
necessarily give you the option. Yeah, to give add you Apple that wallet. Option. Yeah.
Yep. You got it.
Because there've been times when I would love to have a barcode in there that. And it looks like I was reading through the description of it. It gives you all the granularity of putting geolocations on things. So, for instance, like if I don't know if you use, I think you use pre-flight parking in Boston, Dave, occasionally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I get near there, it tends to pop up. Hey, you're near pre-flight parking. And so I think you can geofence it as well so that, you know, these things will pop up when you go into Chipotle or Staples or something like that. It says, hey, you're near, you know, do you need this card or.
Huh.
I believe that's what it's saying it can do.
Interesting.
Yeah, basically, so. You can, I mean, there's, you can create a pass with code, right? JSON code and a bunch of things. I forget, there's a way to put them together, right? That they, and you can load them onto your device. My understanding, and I've used this app before, is basically this is just a user interface for all of that, and it does all that work for you without having to, like, code anything. So, lets you take an image of your barcode or your QR code. And then, like you said, it has provides different templates for different looks. You can put in the additional information that goes on the back, like the address of where the thing is, which would then automatically activate the geolocation stuff for you. So it's, I've used this before. It's a nice little app and it's a great for exactly what that is like anything that you have a barcode or a QR code or something for where they don't actually let you create a pass with their app or through their website, you can create your own pass.
That's really handy because a lot of times I'll get an email with like, here's your coupon for Tideline Public House because you're such a frequent customer or something. And it's like, wait, where is that stupid thing in my email? Like I, you know, but I could create it in the moment and then I know it's just in my wallet and I'm good to go. So yeah.
Yep.
Interesting. Love it. Cool. Well, I think that's gonna do it for us.
How about I unmute my mic there too? I was talking.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just
Pete.
Asked me. I heard myself. So the app is free, and it says it has some in-app purchases available. But the other thing I found really interesting, it talks about app privacy. Down at the bottom, it says data used to track you. The following data may be used to track you across apps and websites owned by other companies. Browsing history. Data not linked to you. The following data may be collected, but it's not linked to your identity. Browsing history.
Like, okay. Well, so it tracks your browsing history, but it doesn't link it to your user account, or at least not to you in the Pass to You app. If you're visiting another company, then sure. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. All right, cool.
I hear musica.
Yeah, the music's playing, Pete. We started the music while you were muted, but I think you could hear us.
I could hear you just fine. I'm I could sure hear me just fine.
Yeah, yeah, the mix was perfect for you.
Loud enough.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting because, like, locally here, if I were to mute myself on my little mixer setup, I would not hear me, and I would know immediately that I was muted.
Right.
But when you mute just the input to StreamYard, you have no idea that it's muted unless it tells you, which it clearly
right because I'm getting the side tone in my
you're getting headphones. The side if I were to hit mute locally here, my side tone in my ears would also be muted, and so like I would know right away. Like, wait, there's no Dave.
Okay,
can't hear Dave. Dave's not here.
Dave's not here, man. That's right.
All right. Thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks for 19 years and counting of doing this show. It's amazing that we get
we barely talked about that, Dave. 19 years.
19
That's
years.
A lot.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I know. It's a long time. Yeah. 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 It's, we started this show right before, I guess technically we released the first one right after we moved into this house. We moved up here to New Hampshire.
Yeah.
It started like the planning of it started before we left, but the first one was released right after we moved in up here. So it's an easy milestone for me when people say, "How long have you lived in New Hampshire?" I know. It's like, "Oh, well, it's, you know, 19 years and 4 days or something, you know."
Hey, there you go.
But
I listened to the first one recently.
And, yeah,
it was kind of funny. If don't take this wrong, Dave. If you folks need a sleeping assist, go listen to the first one
because
it's very much like this. You know, just relaxed. And,
and then
you put more energy into it. Greens!
Right. Yeah. No, it evolved.
Yeah.
It's been a little while since I've listened to the first one, but it's out there. You know the. It's at mgg.fm/1 is how to get there. So you can go listen. And for those of you who were keeping track, it turns out Mac Geek episode 6 had lost its link to the audio file. It's somewhere along the lines. I think it was in the migration of Mac Observer or something like that. But I fixed that. So one of you, and I can't remember who, was going back to the very beginning and is actually going to listen to the whole thing all the way through to see how long it takes. Good on you.
Do the math.
Yeah, exactly. Know. An hour plus times what, you know, 10:42. So, But they said, gosh, no, episode 6 is missing. Do you possibly have the audio file? I'm like, we definitely have it. It's probably out there. It's just not... We're not pointing to it properly, so I was able to fix that. But yeah, it the first one is it's terribly boring. It's awful.
Yeah, the first MacCast is actually a lot of the early MacCasts are horrible too. I wouldn't wish them on anybody. But luckily for me, people did stay and listen, and I'm appreciative of that because definitely you evolve. You know, it was cheap USB mic recorded in my car on my lunch break, you know, on my, I think, probably iBook G3 at the time or something like that. I don't know, whatever it was.
Funny.
Yeah, wow.
Funny.
Yeah.
But for the record, 10 24 hours is 43.42 days. So if on average each one of those episodes is an hour, it's going to take you 43.42 days to listen to all of them,
and they're longer. I think on average it's longer than an hour. First ones were shorter than an hour, but I think we've especially as we keep talking here, adding to the minutes. Fascinating. Yeah, exactly. We can make this 45 days. If you want to come hear us talk though in person, come to MacStock. The three of us will be there. We are doing a Mac Geek Gab Live. It seems like it's going to be Friday night. Like the three of us were all like, we're all happy about that. Great. Then it is now official. It is Friday night. But we've talked to Mike at MacStock about it. Like this is all good. And that's later in July in about a month. And you can save $30 on your pass using coupon code MacGeekGab at MacStock. And that, you know, that'll get you, that's not just the MacGeekGab thing that, that you get to see there, but it'll be an episode. Like, we'll record it and release it on, onto the feed. I don't know if we will have video to release onto the feed or not, but we'll definitely have audio. We'll probably have video. But yeah, so we'll do that on Friday night, and then we're there all weekend, assuming there's no weird issue that causes any of us to have to leave early. So
July 12th through the 14th.
Great.
And that's in
Friday, July 12th.
Crystal Lake, Illinois. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's all at one center now. Like, it's the hotel and the conference center are in the same location, which is a first for MacStock, and I think is going to make it feel even more like camp than MacStock usually does. So,
yeah.
Always a good time.
Yep. Yeah. You want to tell them how we're getting there, Pete?
We're coming in a Tiger. A 91 Grumman Tiger. Yeah. Yep. So, we should get there. About, it's going to be about 6.5-7 hours, depending on headwinds.
Okay. Fun.
With one fuel stop.
Does that 6.5-7 hours include the fuel stop, or is, will the fuel stop be added to that?
No, I think the fuel stop will add to it, just because I think after 3.5-4 hours of riding, we're going to want to stretch our legs and get a sandwich.
Get a sandwich and all that. Yeah, of course. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's part of the fun of it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Your time is going to be close to my time driving it. So
there you go. We can, we could fly straight there, but Pete doesn't fly out 60 miles out over Lake Michigan, single engine.
Nope. Dave doesn't want to do that either. I like the idea of a glider being able to land on land, unless it's a seaplane.
Right.
But I know yours is not. So
exactly. In fact, recently when I went down to North Carolina, it was kind of crappy when we left New Hampshire, and I got rerouted. And so I'm copying down the route, and I do the whole thing, and I started plugging it into the GPS. And they've got me way south of Long Island, and I called the ATC back and went, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I ain't going there.
Yeah.
What's your other plan?
Yeah, what's
the other nice about going wet. But as soon as I told them, I said, I'm single engine. I'm not going out over the water. Yeah. They went, okay. You can go this way then.
That's so great. That's cool that they're cool about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be a blast. So
likewise.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, folks. Yeah, thanks for hanging out. Thanks to CashFly for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Thanks to our sponsors. You can always learn at MacGeekGab.com/sponsors about all the current deals. And then, of course, the two for this episode, ecam.live with coupon code MacGeekGab, same one that you'd use at MacStock, and coda.io/MGG. But really, as I said initially, thanks to all of you. Like, this is, we love that we get to do this. So thank you. Got any words of thanks or anything else to share with them, Adam?
I think we can tell them don't get caught.
That's good.
Made on a Mac.
Later.